Welcome to the Health Edge. I'm Mark Pettis. Great to be with you. I came upon a study recently that I wanted to share with you that looks at a particular type of saturated fat in dairy and a fat that continues to suggest very significant health promotion. With respect to various mechanisms that have been studied. And the reason I wanted to share this with you is because I think, as many of you know, particularly if you've been following my work and John's work for the last several years, that we've been doing this work for a long, long time. And there have been so many changes in the science. There have been so many challenges with respect to dogma at many levels, particularly nutritional science, extent to which our medical model, as you all know, is just very poorly designed to promote health, to extend life, and to expand health span or quality of life. So it's been a humbling journey, needless to say. And this study, I think, is just another bit of evidence, albeit not one that's going to make the front page news of any mainstream media outlet. There may be a few people that are out there doing podcasts that really follow this science closely. But it's a piece of evidence that continues to fly in the face of conventional wisdom. And in this example, a full-fat dairy has been condemned for some time now as part of this broader mantra of low-fat guidelines. And again, there's just a ton of commentary on this. For every PhD, there's an equal and opposite PhD. For every MD, there is an equal and opposite MD. So there's nothing that I would suggest in much of the medical enterprise that is an absolute truth. This is an actively evolving landscape. And I thought this study was certainly significant enough to bring to your attention. And I'll provide a few other corroborating studies that would suggest that for anyone who likes dairy and incorporates dairy into their nutritional day-to-day life, that full fat is totally the way to go. And in a perfect world, I think we would see people steering away from skim milk, low-fat milk, 1% milk, 2% milk. And that really is the case that I wish to share with you. And like most things that I share and that John share, this is in no way intended to convince you as much as it is an attempt to offer what's out there and then to allow you to discern and to consider whether the choices that you've been making serve you as well as you could be served. So that's just some broader context for what I want to share with you. Before I get into this study, this is the graph that, in my opinion, is one of the more meaningful and interesting graphics that I've ever seen. This was adapted from what was published in 1982 by the great late physicist Buckminster Fuller in his book Critical Path. And he described what he called the knowledge doubling curve. This is the extent to which over time knowledge doubles. And it's really a remarkable curve. You know, at the turn of the 20th century and for millennia prior to that, the amount of accumulating knowledge was very, very limited. And about once every 100 years at that time, knowledge was doubling. This was a very slow acquisition. Of course, back then, there wasn't internet, there wasn't easy ways to share knowledge, and things tended to move very slowly. And when you get to the end of World War II, you see this gradual acceleration, knowledge doubling every 25 years. And we can think back historically. There was a lot happening at the end of World War II, and we started to quickly move into more technology advances in information sharing. And in 1982, which is around when I graduated from medical school, knowledge was doubling almost every year. This was a very significant ascension. And at that time, there was still no internet. You would go to the library, you would access information from journals and printed materials, and you were charged with trying to, as a caregiver, certainly as a physician, to try to incorporate as much of that new and emerging knowledge as you could in your service to others. And then look what's happened to this curve. We're now in this accelerated explosion of knowledge where, IBM predicted knowledge would double literally every 11 to 12 hours. That is extraordinary. And this is the information revolution that we are now all in. No human being prior to us has coexisted in an ecosystem where so much new information was emerging in such a short time. Now, one of the things that's really important to keep in mind, and this has been a very humbling journey for me. I'm a nephrologist by training. I had really excellent training. I trained at Harvard graduate medical programs and did my renal training at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And it at that time, there was in addition to this explosion of knowledge, there was this sense that the science in many instances was sort of settled, and these were truths, and these were truths that were incontrovertible. And examples of that for me was the genetic predeterministic evidence for life. Most of these things that affect our disease risk and how long we live were largely genetically predetermined. That was considered to be the science at the time. And even today, that dogma continues to be prevalent. Epigenetics has turned that on its head. Another example of knowledge that I embraced at that time that I was taught to be an absolute truth was the extent to which lifestyle was had very sort of limited, it was important, but it had limited value ultimately in influencing day-to-day quality of life. And ours was a model very much of disease diagnosis and treatment, most of which was pharmacologic, continues to this day. And many of these truths you just held on to. Blood pressure was a genetic disease, diabetes, a genetic disease, and that became what was etched in my brain and in the scores of thousands of medical professionals that were acquiring their training at the time. This is a quote that I really like from Dr. David Sackett, who was one of the thought leaders in the development of evidence-based medicine. And Sackett famously said, "Half of what you learn in medical school will be shown to either be dead wrong or out of date within 5 years of your graduation. The trouble is, nobody can tell you which half, so that the most important thing to learn is how to learn on your own. And I look back on that quote and I've been reminded time and time again of how true that is. And when I begin to challenge myself to say, wow, what is it today that I think about in the exact same way that I did 5 years ago? And is it possible that some of what I cling to and believe as an absolute truth may be dead wrong was a very hard pill to swallow. It's always easier to hold on to that which you believe to be true, whether it turns out to be true or not. And as a clinician, I very much trusted the sources of truth. There were experts in their particular fields. There were journals that had the reputation of being first-class peer-reviewed journals, and anything that you read and acquired from those sources of information were as good as it could possibly get. And the extent to which you could begin to apply that emerging knowledge from those trusted sources, the better off you would be as a clinician and as a human service professional. And it was the guidelines. You would go to the guidelines of our established organizations, right? Organizations like the American Heart Association and the American Diabetes Association, the American Cancer Association. You kept up with your, continuing medical education, with all of the board certifications and these organizations for whom, by the way, you spend a fair amount of money to achieve these accolades that ultimately suggested that you were on top of your game. That is how this playbook has been designed, and certainly that is how most healthcare professionals and those who serve others have been part of that same playbook. Now, which is not to say that everything you learn is inaccurate, but the knowledge doubling curve would suggest that any individual, in my opinion, who is serving others and ultimately serving themselves has to be inherently skeptical of consensus thinking. And I won't get into this, but there's been no shortage of examples of this with respect to the pandemic and all of the many suggestions and conflicted sources of information, the censorship. If you did not follow consensus thinking as a professional caregiver, you were going to get marginalized. You might, if you had a podcast, you were probably going to have your site taken down. If you try to challenge the consensus thinking, you were going to be very much shunned and marginalized by your peers. And you risked your reputation, you risked your job security. And that has been a very unsettling, and I think more transparent window into this sort of knowledge enterprise. And so I just want to provide a bit of a broader context for the ecosystem within which we are all navigating and attempting in some way to extract from that ecosystem the information that can best serve that which we value. Now, this is also a quote that I have thought about often from Dr. Marcia Engel. Dr. Engel was the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine out of the Massachusetts Medical Society, which I was a member for much of my professional life. This was a journal that, again, anyone would have considered it the quintessential source of truth. And Dr. Engel reminded us in a very courageous way, after she stepped down from this role, and I will quote her, "It is simply no longer possible to believe much of the clinical research that is published, or to rely on the judgment of trusted physicians or authoritative medical guidelines." I take no pleasure in this conclusion, which I reached slowly and reluctantly over my two decades as an editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. And more academics who have committed their lives in very remarkable ways with great sacrifice have reached the same conclusion. There are many conflicts of interest in the research enterprise. There are many financial conflicts. There is a publish or perish mentality that will make more likely any data that's not consistent with that which you are pursuing will be suppressed. There are grant monies and issues of a sort of authority and power and ego that will feed the tendency and the bias that can take what is an otherwise scientific method and translate it in a way that brings you further from the truth. And so while this is a decidedly skeptical and cynical perspective, I think I can at least say after 40 years of actually being in these ecosystems where I continue to navigate that, you know, this really is an issue of being mindful that at the end of the day, the greatest evidence you will ever have is how you feel, how you are doing in response to the choices that you are making. And this is just a broader context for the study that I'm going to review, which is suggesting that there is a saturated fat in dairy, which may be incredibly health promoting. And having pushed low fat or having eliminated this nutritional source from the general public for the last couple of generations may be creating more harm. And so let's just look at this study. And this is a bit, it will come across a bit esoteric, but it really isn't. This is, the study is in Nutrients. This was just published very recently. And the study is the pentadecanoic acid. This is a saturated fat. And like all saturated fats, the labeling refers to the number of carbons. So there are 15 carbons. And the zero means there are no double bonds. Saturated fats, as John Bagnulo and I have talked about for years, have no double bonds. And so a double bond would make it easier to be oxidized. And as I think all of our Health Edge listeners know, oxidation, while it's a natural and inevitable byproduct of human metabolism, can reach a place where the burden of oxidative stress can begin to influence function. And function ultimately is where human life emerges. And that requires, I think, a much more self-care, stewardship, and awareness. And so this is an essential fatty acid, shares clinically relevant cell-based activities with leading longevity-enhancing compounds. So what does all of that mean, and why is it important, if it's important at all? The greatest source of this 15-carbon saturated fat is in full-fat dairy, whether that be milk, whether it be butter, whether it be cheeses, yogurts. The value is in the fat, the full fat fraction of that dairy product. Now, there are other many great things in dairy in terms of its bioavailability, its broad and complete amino acid protein complement, as well as many other very important fat soluble vitamins, vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin E, vitamin K, et cetera. But in this instance, they're looking at this particular saturated fat. Now, this is very sophisticated research that can take different types of human cells So these are cell systems that they are looking at, and they compared this particular saturated fat, right, the pentadecanoic acid. This is a natural ingredient in full fat dairy, and they compared it with what are two of the more widely studied molecules in the aging and longevity research. Metformin, which many of you are aware of, is a treatment for type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance, and rapamycin, a what is called an mTOR inhibitor. Rapamycin most commonly has been used in the transplant care arena, and I've prescribed and have followed many, many people on rapamycin with kidney transplants. So these are medicines that have been around for a long time, and they have great clinical value in those examples. But they are being looked at specifically with respect to how they alter hallmarks of aging. And pentadecanoic acid was compared with these two widely studied agents. So what they found was that the saturated fat, this 15 carbon, odd number chained carbon, and the odd number chained carbon saturated fats seem to have some uniquely beneficial properties. Two of which are to activate this AMP kinase metabolic pathway. AMPK, as we frequently refer to it, is kind of like a metabolic acupressure point. Stimulating that acupressure point seems to bring more balanced metabolic biochemistry to that organism. Utilization of glucose as a fuel, burning of fat, regulation of metabolism in terms of energy expenditure, et cetera, insulin signaling. It also inhibits mTOR, this mammalian target of rapamycin. So, inhibition of mTOR, while it can suppress an immune response to somebody with a transplanted organ, also seems to be associated with many of the hallmarks of healthy aging and longevity, which would include, for example, lowering inflammation, altering epigenetic gene expression patterns that sort of activate the software that we need for greater resiliency, for repair, for rejuvenation. And so this saturated fat seemed to have very similar activity to rapamycin and metformin. It created a reduction in inflammation. You can measure in all of these cell types the activity in various metabolic pathways. And these are central metabolic pathways that seem to very much drive either one's resilience and health span and longevity potential, or depending on how well it's working, it may have the opposite effect of compressing one's life expectancy and creating a much broader and significant burden of chronic complex disease. So, things that tend to be really good for our metabolic ecosystem are anti-inflammatory, they're anti-fibrotic. You're not getting as much of that scar tissue, that clot formation. It reduces some of the drivers of cancer and enables that software that can recognize a rogue cancer cell. We have software, as I talk about this often, and the epigenetic research, which is has revolutionized the way that I think about human biology. When you look at the extent to which the software is already built in, but very much suppressed by this mismatch between our evolutionary biologic mandate and these modern ecosystems that confront us with unhealthy foods and poor quality light and 24/7 stress and conflict and fear-mongering. And then guidelines that have perhaps, despite good intentions, have suggested that any food that has fat in it should be avoided at all costs. Well, those fats ultimately were replaced by processed carbohydrates. So again, all one has to do is to look at the current state of American health, which quite frankly is really poor, and getting worse by the generation, and asking the question, how did this happen? Because this is not the normal expected trajectory of the Homo sapien. So in this example, a natural food, dairy, and I would remind everyone that even though we weren't raised on cow's milk, human breast milk is, the healthiest food on the planet for humans, particularly for those young infants and early childhood, which, by the way, has a lot of saturated fat in it. As we got further away from the value of whole foods that humans have evolved with, as well as other mammals have evolved with, we have gotten further away from that which can activate the software, which is already built into our system that assures a longer life and a greater health span. This 15 carbon saturated fat targeted most of these metabolic hallmarks of aging. This is a paper and some research that I reviewed some time back. I would encourage anyone who wants to learn more about the hallmarks of aging to go back to that recording. Very favorable for mitigating diabetes risk, heart disease risk, cancer, fatty liver disease, things that are associated with poor metabolic health. Just a few other studies that I want to share that corroborate some of these themes in this paper. And this, I wanted to give you a little bit of a historical perspective. So if you go back about 20 years, this was published by the American Society of Clinical Nutrition, pentadecanoic acid in serum as a marker of intake of milk fat, the relationship between the intake of milk fat and metabolic risk factors. And what they found was that people that have higher levels of this saturated fat in their bloodstream, as a marker of consumption of full fat dairy, seem to have much lower metabolic risk. And as I also reviewed recently, metabolic health is becoming increasingly rare in the United States. Less than 10% of Americans would meet criteria for good metabolic health. So this was back in 1999. And basically, what they found was that there was an inverse association. Those that consume more full fat dairy that had higher pentadecanoic acid levels in their blood tended to have a lower body mass index, waist circumference, LDL, higher HDL levels, their glucose was lower. All of the metabolic biomarkers seemed to be very favorably related to higher levels of this saturated fat. How can that be if, in fact, saturated fat is bad for you? Saturated fat is a family of fats, okay? So it's not like, this is a simple black and white analysis as it has been painted to be for the last couple of generations. Here's another study. This is just moving the timeline a bit forward here. This is from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition in 2014. Dietary fat intake is associated with glucose tolerance. In other words, lower blood glucoses, more insulin sensitivity. And insulin sensitivity is your hallmark to health. Anyone who is insulin resistant, prediabetes, diabetes, and many people with these issues have no idea that they're insulin resistant. That will be your passport to aging. And in time, something will come up. You may develop heart disease. You may be diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. You may learn that your memory's beginning to fail, and there'll be this sense of, where did this come from? I've been consuming low-fat dairy like the guidelines have suggested all of my life. How can that possibly be, right? This is just another example of the association between this particular saturated fat in dairy and much improved metabolic ecosystems. And again, the hypothesis here is that dairy fat improves glucose tolerance, possibly through a mechanism involving hepatic and systemic insulin sensitivity. This is completely counter to what the traditional public health messaging and nutritional epidemiology has suggested and continues to suggest. These are human studies, by the way. This is a more recent study from 2021. Pentadecanoic acid promotes basal and insulin-stimulated glucose uptake. And this is looking at myocardial cells. This is muscle. And so just another example of research out there. That research was from China. Here's a study from 2020, right? Pentadecanoic acid, an eye-chain fatty acid, suppresses human breast cancer-like cells. And again, does so by altering signals. It activates the software that, in this example, would allow a woman who may be starting to evolve toward breast cancer to have those cells recognized, suppressed, taken out. And it is just another example metabolically of how a molecule, a saturated fat in a whole unprocessed food, is being shown in these different data sources to have very interesting mechanistic properties, all of which together could suggest very important promotion of human health, longevity, and quality of life. These saturated fats, and these are just examples of different saturated fats. We're focusing on this 15-carbon pentadecanoic acid, has been also shown to have epigenetic effects. And we call this HDAC inhibition. HDAC, one of the many acronyms, stands for histone deacetylase inhibition or function. And it is the histone in our DNA, our book of life, that has on and off switches that can alter which genes get read and which genes are suppressed. And these are very active dynamic processes. And so this is an example of nutritional epigenetics and an example of saturated fats that may have very important health-promoting epigenetic effects. Another example of this that John and I have talked about is butyrate, butyric acid. This is a four-carbon saturated fat. And butyrate comes largely from fermentation of fiber by the gut microbiome. Certain species of the biome produce butyrate. Butyrate was shown several years ago to have very important epigenetic effects. And so, again, these are just some examples that should call into question these dogmatic conclusions about the safety or risk of a particular group of foods that is taken completely out of context of a complex holistic life and the many choices that comprise that life, as well as the complexities of food and the many molecules in those foods that act in concert to alter human biology. And one's biology becomes their biography. And so as I get to sort of the end of this research, I wanted to share with you, this is just a paper recently from Scientific Reports 2020. Again, the eye-chain saturated fat pentadecanoic acid parallels broad associated health human benefits. Could this in fact be an essential fatty acid? And it's a very provocative and I think important question to be asking. Essential implies that the body can't make it. So the only way to get this is from nutritional sources. And again, full fat dairy in this example would be the best source of pentadecanoic acid. And just some conclusions from this study. This is the first demonstration of pentadecanoic acid's direct role in attenuating multiple comorbidities using relevant physiological mechanisms at established circulating concentration. So they take circulating levels that have been demonstrated, apply those levels to tissues, to cell types. They look at broader epidemiology and observational studies. And in totality, you begin to see how the dots get connected and some interesting conclusions. Pairing our findings with evidence that this saturated fat is not readily made endogenously. You can't make this. Lower dietary intake and lower blood concentrations are associated with higher mortality and poorer physiological state. And number three, this saturated fat has demonstrated activities and efficacy that parallels associated health benefits in humans. We propose that pentadecanoic acid as a potential essential fatty acid, and further studies are needed to evaluate the potential impact that decades of recommendations to reduce intake of this has had as a contributor to deficiency states and susceptibility to chronic disease. So that is a again an example of what I would consider to be part of a knowledge explosion that most of your regulatory bodies, many of your peer-reviewed journals, many of your academic institutions that are training registered dietitians or physicians or nurses or nurse practitioners or physician assistants, these are not nimble institutions. They're not going to be able to extract from knowledge that is doubling every 12 hours a principle that will quickly lead to adaptation of the educational playbooks, many of which are heavily influenced by the industries that support them, by recommendations that can be very hard to challenge. Because as we've seen, if you start saying saturated fat is good, you are going to quickly find yourself an outsider looking in, whether it's the medical staff you're on, whether it's the organization that you're working for, whether it's the peers and friends that you thought knew and loved you that are going to start to consider you radioactive. At the risk of pontificating, the take-home point for me is that any tendency that I would have ever had in my dairy consumption to choose a no-fat, low-fat, reduced-fat fraction has been thrown out the window. I've been consuming whole-fat dairy for many, many years. I've gone against complete traditional recommendations. And many of you who know my history know that my family history is really poor for cardiovascular disease and diabetes. When I began to consume more fat from healthy sources, full fat dairy, pasture-raised meats, eggs, fish, nuts, avocados, I began to see dramatic changes in my health, my function, my quality of life. I follow my coronary calcium scores. I follow my cardiovascular and metabolic biomarkers as closely as anyone can. Everything got better when I started to challenge the conventional wisdom that was guiding me in the direction of poor quality fats like processed seed, vegetable oils, more low-fat foods, which were, in retrospect, higher glycemic processed carbohydrates, which really is driving most chronic complex diseases. and began to just question everything that I had been learned. And that, that as a consumer, as a healthcare professional, and as someone who cares a lot about other people, I would just suggest that you might rethink. If you like dairy, not everyone does, that's okay. I'm not suggesting you eat dairy if you don't like it. But if you're avoiding dairy, much like red meat, as I discussed in my last podcast, because of the guidelines and because of what you're hearing, then I would suggest you introduce more of these foods and see how you feel, see how you do, see what happens to your waist circumference, to your blood pressure, to your biomarkers, most importantly, how you feel and how you're functioning. And in my experience, and in the thousands of people that I have partnered with who have jumped off this consensus thinking gravy train, they have experienced many of the same things. And once you begin to realize that, it gives you more courage to continue to push those edges. And that is the challenge of being a modern human in an era where knowledge is doubling every 12 hours. I hope this was of some interest to you. If you liked it, please share it with your friends and colleagues. I don't do a lot of social media, so a lot of the growth of this is by word of mouth. And I appreciate your listening to the Health Edge. I hope your holiday season continues to be joyous and peaceful. And until next time, be well and stay well. Thank you.